When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It had it all. Science fiction, computer imagery, space. It had heart, warmth, great characters, and a great soundtrack. It even featured an unexpected but familiar voice. Film technology was showing us things on screen we had never seen before, and we witnessed the thrill of being able to travel in a flying saucer. Some of us saw it in theaters. Some would discover it on home video, but ultimately, it made a big impact on a generation of kids. I'm Jamie Logie, and this is Everything 80s, a podcast that looks back on a decade that forever changed the way we dress, consume, and connected. And today, we look back on the movie that was a bit of a science fiction gem, a film that technologically was quite ahead of its time, and just may have helped influence the future of movie making. This is the history of Flight of the Navigator. The beginning of Flight of the Navigator teases us early with scenes hinting at a flying saucer. At the beginning of the film, silver frisbees look like a UFO flying through the air. The sun is also blocked out by a huge ship, which turns out to be a blimp. It's 1978, and David Freeman is a 12-year-old kid living in Florida with his parents and brother Matt. David also has a dog, and the family lives near the water and owns a boat. Life seems pretty ordinary, until one night when David's mother sends him to meet his younger brother. While walking through the woods, David feels uneasy. He sees what may be a spacecraft of some sort, but it turns out to be a water tower. Then, David ends up stumbling and falling down into a wooded ravine, knocking himself out. After what appears to be just a few moments, he is awoken by the sound of a train and makes his way back home. His home, however, has different people in it. The authorities are called, and as they search their database, they realize David has been reported missing 8 years ago. David is taken to another house where he sees what appears to be his parents, but they have aged. His younger brother Matt is now an older teenager. David has no idea what has happened and how he has somehow transported years into the future. He is the same, but everything around him has aged. To get to the bottom of what happened, David is taken to a hospital where a series of tests are conducted. His brainwave patterns are off the chart, even revealing the shape of a bizarre-looking object. It looks like some sort of spacecraft. David's brainwaves have gone haywire. Meanwhile, NASA has discovered a spacecraft, but no one can get into it. This is when they become aware of the 12-year-old boy that has produced a brainwave image that perfectly matches the craft they've found. David is brought into NASA so they can try to understand how he's been gone for 8 years and why he hasn't aged. As they run tests on David's brain, he reveals a vast amount of information, including star charts throughout the universe. David's brain is answering questions for him, and it's also revealed that he's been on a planet called Phalon. This also means that David has traveled at the speed of light, which explains why he hasn't aged while everyone else has. The sessions are tough on David, who, thinking he is going to leave soon, finds out he's staying longer than planned. With the help of an employee named Carolyn, David sneaks out of his room into the hangar with the spacecraft. For the first time, the craft opens up, producing some stairs to let David aboard. The ship has a robotic pilot that David ends up calling Max based on the name of the ship, the Trimaxian drone ship. The scientists discover that David is aboard the ship, and the ship takes off before they can stop him. Max, who speaks in a robotic voice, needs to retrieve the star charts from David's brain. Max had come to Earth to collect specimens, which included David, who was then taken back to Phalon. But since humans are so fragile, David couldn't be returned to the time he was picked up. When David was returned to 1986, the ship hit some power lines, erasing the star charts. Max eventually does the scan on David's brain to retrieve them, with the deal that David will be returned home. The scan is complete, but Max picks up the contents from the brain of a 12-year-old kid. This completely changes Max, giving him a personality and unique voice. If you grew up in the 80s, that voice probably sounded familiar to you, and we'll get back to that in a bit. Max eventually takes David home, but this is 1986, not 1978, and David wants to go back to the world he knew, and that means taking the risk to be taken back in time. David eventually wakes up in the same ravine he fell into and arrives home to find everything the way it was, except for one of the creatures he had taken from the ship that was stowed away in his backpack. Flight of the Navigator stars Joey Kramer's David, Veronica Cartwright as David's mother Helen, Cliff DeYoung as David's father Bill, and Matt Adler as David's brother at 16 years old. Howard Hessman plays Dr. Faraday, and you may recognize him as Dr. Johnny Fever from WKRP in Cincinnati. He was also Sam from One Day at a Time. A young Sarah Jessica Parker also plays the role of Carolyn. I grew up a massive Pee Wee Herman fan. From Pee Wee's Big Adventure to Pee Wee's Playhouse, Paul Reubens created one of the most unique characters ever. If you're like me, when you heard the voice change from Max the first time, you were probably astonished to hear Pee-wee Herman's voice. I remember sticking around after the movie ended to watch the end credits, only to see that the voice of Max was performed by a Paul Mull. I knew that Pee-wee Herman's real name was Paul Reubens. So who was Paul Mull, which is also the name of a brand of cigarettes? Was someone called Paul Mull brought in to do a Pee-wee Herman impression? Well, it really was Paul Reubens. And according to IMDb, it was Reubens who wanted to keep his cameo in the movie a secret. That meant no mention in the opening credits, unique considering Max is one of the main characters in the movie. And that meant an alias during the end credits. By 1986, the character of Pee-wee Herman was incredibly famous and well-known, and Paul Reubens wanted to keep things low-key so as to not distract from the movie. And this brings up an interesting question within the context of the film. Max has scanned David's brain and retrieved information associated with a kid growing up in America in the late 70s, including the McDonald's Big Mac jingle of two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. And I think we're to assume that Pee-wee Herman would have been ingrained in the mind of a 12-year-old kid in 1986. The movie is set in 1986 when Pee-wee Herman was huge, but David is coming from 1978. Paul Reubens created the Pee Wee Herman character in 1977 while part of the Groundlings improv comedy group in Los Angeles. The first television appearance of Pee Wee Herman is considered to be in 1979 on The Dating Game, which aired on ABC. As the 80s began, the character of Pee Wee Herman began to appear on David Letterman in a Cheech and Chong movie, and then the Pee Wee Herman stage show that aired on HBO. Pee Wee's Big Adventure didn't come out until 1985, and Pee Wee's Playhouse didn't begin until the fall of 1986, meaning that in 1978, the only way David would have known about Pee Wee Herman is if he had taken a trip to see the Groundlings live. The origins of Flight of the Navigator all come from a dream. In the documentary Life After the Navigator, Mark Baker, who had never written a screenplay before, put together a script called Vanished. The premise of the story came from a dream that Baker had. This first idea was a bit more serious than what we got and was based on the ship being built from David's memory. In this early version, building the ship requires technology that no one understands, except for David. The early version of the film was taken to Disney, and it was approved by the board of directors, who picked up the domestic distribution rights. This isn't a Disney film per se, as Disney then set up a partnership deal with a production company called the Producer Sales Organization, or PSO, and also with Viking Films. PSO has been connected to films like An American Werewolf in Paris, Cujo, and The Neverending Story. PSO wanted to make something more on the serious side like the original script. Disney wanted a family movie. So director Randall Kleiser, who went to USC Film School with John Carpenter and George Lucas, was stuck in the middle of these two different directions. Kleiser also worked on the movie Grease, and you may have noticed he included the song You're the One That I Want playing in the Freeman's car when they come back from the Frisbee competition at the start of the film. Disney was obviously the most powerful, so the new project skewed toward the family side of filmmaking. But the movie still kept that science fiction element to it, and remained somewhat serious despite having a lighter tone. Flight of the Navigator centered around a young performer, so casting was extensive, taking place in multiple cities with hundreds of auditions. Some of the young actors who came in for the role of David included Chris O'Donnell and Joaquin Phoenix. But the movie's search was to find the best performer who could convey the emotion they were looking for. The movie depended on this, and they found that in Joey Kramer from BC, Canada. Kramer appeared in the movie Runaway alongside Tom Selleck and was great at nailing a scene in just one take. With the cast in place, filming would take place in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Some of the movie was also filmed in Norway. For a movie based on space and science fiction, technology would be a key part of this film. This is the mid-80s, and some movie special effects didn't always look so good. Sometimes, they could be downright distracting. Would Flight of the Navigator be able to take us into a world that didn't distract us with unrealistic imagery? Flight of the Navigator was about to show us how CGI, a term we didn't necessarily know yet, could truly impact a movie as unique new technology pushed the boundaries of visual storytelling.
Everything 80s will return after these messages.
Besides the character of David, there is another main character of sorts in Flight of the Navigator that is instrumental to the movie working. Not just Max, but the spaceship itself. The ship was designed by Edward Eyth, a recent graduate of CalArts. Eyth would eventually be involved in creating visual concepts for movies like The Rocketeer, Big Top Pee-wee, and Back to the Future 2. He also created concept designs for an elaborate Disney attraction from the 80s that I have a previous episode all about. It was called Captain EO, and it starred Michael Jackson. Eyth also designed all the creatures that lived aboard the spaceship. Director Randall Kleiser was looking for a way to make this movie stand out visually in a way we hadn't really seen before. Fortunately, Randall had a brother named Jeff. Jeffrey Kleiser founded an early computer animation company in New York called Digital Effects. The company was creating visual effects for TV commercials through computers, and this is also the company that provided visual effects for 1982's Tron. These effects were pretty revolutionary, and Randall Kleiser wanted something similar for Flight of the Navigator. He wanted the spaceship to look like it was from space. It needed to look futuristic, and it should be able to change shape depending on its location or how it was traveling through the air. The ship should be one shape while stationary, but elongate and become sleeker while traveling through the sky. To create the look of the ship, Digital Effects used what is called reflection mapping. This is that chrome look that reflects the environment around the object. But this isn't like a mirror, as the reflection of, say, water has to look slightly different because of the unique shape of the ship. That's a pretty complicated process, especially back in the mid-80s. According to Life After the Navigator, this was one of the very first times this technology had been used in a feature film. The effects were complicated, but coming together better than expected. Jeffrey Kleiser also shares that James Cameron told him that the spaceship technology from Flight of the Navigator inspired him when creating the T-1000 in Terminator 2. A new era in visual effects had now begun. But this was expensive. VFXblog.com shares that just a gigabyte of storage when making Terminator 2 cost $9,000. For Flight of the Navigator, production was also expensive, and with a budget of only around $9 million, they wanted to save money wherever they could. That meant a combination of cutting-edge technology and classic real-life effects. Instead of spending $30,000 on an optical effects shot, they used actual stage magic to create some practical effects. Canadian magician Doug Henning was brought in to work his magic. Example: when David walks up the steps into the spaceship, the steps appear to be floating, but they're moving while he steps on them. These real steps were built with steel rods that went away from the camera that we can't see. There was also a real life-size model of the spaceship used in some of the shots, like at the gator farm called Al's Gator City, which was a ranch that actually belonged to Burt Reynolds. The ship was held up with a crane arm attached to a tow truck and shot from the other side. The ship appears to be slightly moving around because it was, and the arm of the crane was removed in post-production. They even used some old-style movie-making techniques. Earlier in the film, when the ship comes out of the hangar, it's a real ship about the size of a few basketballs, and they use a perspective shift to make the ship appear bigger than it is. According to Looper, two life-size models of the ship were created, a 700-pound one and a 1,400-pound one. After filming, these ships eventually moved to Disney MGM and could be seen in the studio backlot tour alongside one of Jabba the Hutt's skiffs from Return of the Jedi. Apparently, at one point, one of these ships was even repurposed, repainted, and used as a drink station in Tomorrowland. The inside of the ship was another practical effect. This one was made with a mylar-type material that was lit from behind to create a futuristic space-age effect. Then, when you shone a light from inside, the material went clear, so David was able to see through the spaceship. It was another simple but practical effect. Speaking of real-life effects, several puppets were used on board the ship. Tim Blaney was one of the assistant puppeteers on Max and controlled and voiced the little Puckmarin that David takes back home with him. Tim Blaney also helped operate and was the voice of Johnny Five in Short Circuit. Through remarkable new computer animation, puppetry, and classic visual effects, Flight of the Navigator was going to be something we really hadn't ever seen before. When George Lucas was making the first Star Wars, a lot of the early production was a disaster, and his vision wasn't coming to life the way he hoped. So much seemed below expectation, except for one thing that surpassed his wildest expectations: the musical score composed by John Williams. For many movies, the music and soundtrack can be just as important as the visuals on screen. Composer Alan Silvestri, one of the all-time great composers, was the person behind the music. Silvestri has also created the music for a lot of your favorite films. Here's just a sampling: Predator, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, The Abyss, the Back to the Future trilogy, Father of the Bride, Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest, Forrest Gump, The Parent Trap, Castaway, Night at the Museum, and a bunch of MCU movies, including Infinity War and Avengers Endgame. Flight of the Navigator featured some of his most unique work. Because of the limited time and lower budget, Silvestri didn't have access to an orchestra. The music was composed completely on synthesizers. This worked perfectly, too, because it was a space-based movie, and Silvestri created a unique tone and energy to the film. Speaking of music, one key scene includes David and Max singing along to I Get Around by the Beach Boys, an expensive song to get the rights to, but the filmmakers pushed Disney hard enough to get it. And now it's finally time for Flight of the Navigator to hit theaters.
When you're just growing up, every day is a new discovery. But nothing David Freeman has ever experienced will prepare him for the adventure that lies ahead.
The trailer even used a fake voice for Max to not give away that Paul Reubens was in the film. And it came with the tagline, "Come along for the greatest adventure of the summer." But there was a little problem, as there were a lot of great adventures that summer. This is the summer of 1986. All in all, a standout summer for movies. From May to late August, here are just some of the films that came out: The Karate Kid Part 2, Back to School, Aliens, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Legal Eagles, Short Circuit, Friday the 13th Part 6, The Fly, Labyrinth, Stand By Me, Big Trouble in Little China, My Little Pony the Movie, and The Transformers the Movie. It was the summer that seemed to have a movie for everyone, and let's not forget the biggest movie of 1986, Top Gun. The summer of 86 also gave us a few cult classics, including Critters, Maximum Overdrive, and Howard the Duck. Flight of the Navigator was released on July 30th, 1986. But also released around that date were Aliens, Friday the 13th Part 6, and Howard the Duck, which, despite how it ended up being received, had a lot of hype going into its release date. The release of Howard the Duck, produced by George Lucas, also pitted Randall Kleiser up against his old classmate. Then, a week or so after Flight of the Navigator hit theaters, The Fly, Armed and Dangerous, The Transformers the Movie, and Stand By Me are set to be released. Not only that, but movies like The Karate Kid Part 2 and Ferris Bueller's Day Off had barely been out for a month. Flight of the Navigator also had to contend with one of the surprise hits of the summer, Ruthless People, starring Danny DeVito and Bette Midler. With all of the huge competition, Flight of the Navigator took in just over $18 million at the box office. That's around double the production budget, but not exactly a blow-away box office hit. Though it was critically well-received, it was still a tough time to come out. The 1986 New York Times review even said, quote, "The film is so absorbing, such constant fun, that it may well be the best family film around," unquote. According to Looper, the movie that made it the most difficult for Flight of the Navigator to make a big dent at the box office was Aliens, directed by James Cameron. Another interesting connection, considering Flight of the Navigator would influence Cameron for Terminator 2. One place where Flight of the Navigator really found its audience was on home video. The release of the VHS version came out at the perfect time, as this is when the cost of newly released movies was starting to come down. For years, a new movie released on home video was incredibly expensive, up to $80 or more. $80 in, say, 1985, is about $230 in today's money, just for one movie. This was a time before the studios realized how lucrative home video could be. Up to that point, continuous income for a film came from theatrical re-releases. This is one of the reasons why the home video version of a film used to be so expensive. It was a way to offset the loss of the re-release. But you probably remember movies costing less than $80, and we have Top Gun from the summer of 1986 to thank for this. According to Cracked, it was the Top Gun VHS release that brought down prices. Some new releases had dropped down to as low as $40, but Paramount did something new and unique. They dropped Top Gun, the biggest movie of 86, down to $26.95 for its 1987 home release. The big price drop was thanks to a Diet Pepsi commercial front-loading the film. Now, we got movies cheaper, but just had to deal with a commercial at the start. The plan worked, and Top Gun became the best-selling videotape of all time. Pepsi even teamed up with Steven Spielberg for the home video release of E.T., a movie that didn't seem like it would ever hit store shelves as it made money through consistent theatrical re-releases. E.T. ended up being priced even lower at $24.95 and even came with a $5 rebate coupon, bringing it down to $19.95. More and more new releases followed the same model. Buying a brand new release was now affordable, and the prices of home VHS tapes never looked back. The home video release of Flight of the Navigator came out during the period when it could eventually be reasonably priced, making it a day one purchase for many families, including mine, as my brother, sister, and I even pooled our money together to buy it. Flight of the Navigator found a new life on home video, and this is where many kids and families discovered it for the very first time. To me, Flight of the Navigator is a bit of an underrated gem and one of the better science fiction fantasy films of the entire 1980s. After the phenomenal success of Back to the Future in 1985, a kid like me was hyped for anything time travel related. A movie like Flight of the Navigator incorporated time travel, space, UFOs, science fiction, astonishing technology, Pee-wee Herman, and even a few well-timed curse words thrown in to boot, something you didn't often see in a Disney film at the time. But would Flight of the Navigator have benefited more if it wasn't directed at families and associated with Disney? Would it have attracted a bigger audience if it didn't seem intended for a younger audience? There's a lot in this movie that could appeal to an older demographic that may have steered clear because they thought it was just a Disney film. It may have also been a bit too intense for a 4 or 5-year-old, making it fall into that weird gray area between demographics. But regardless of its theatrical run, people still came to see it, and Flight of the Navigator made a big impact on a generation of kids in the 1980s. Whether you saw it in theaters, on home video, or eventually on the Disney Channel, many younger viewers discovered this unique film. Thanks to the incredible CGI that's getting close to 40 years old now, Flight of the Navigator doesn't look dated or cheesy. The CGI is seamless, and I think the spaceship still looks as good as any CGI from even 10 years ago. Talks of a Flight of the Navigator reboot or sequel have been in talks since 2009. They continued in 2017 and right up to a few years ago, with discussions of Bryce Dallas Howard creating something for Disney Plus. If you're listening to this in the future, you'll know if this did or didn't happen. For my brother, sister, and I, Flight of the Navigator was one of our all-time favorite movies when we were growing up. We watched the VHS tape all the time. And I mean all the time. Despite our age differences, it was one of the few agreed-upon things that didn't result in a blow-up argument that caused my mom to ban us from the TV for the entire day. The three of us would all watch together, my brother and I would watch, or just my sister and I, or it may be just the two of them watching together. This is a movie that we watched so much, we actually broke the tape. At the time, Flight of the Navigator was just a beloved movie, and I never realized how ahead of its time it really was. So that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. If you're just joining me for the first time today, I have a ton of previous episodes covering all the things we love from the 1980s. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the Everything 80s podcast wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes. If you're a fan of 1980s movies, you may want to check out the Everything 80s Movie Review podcast over at patreon.com. If you want to check that out or learn more, just head on over to patreon.com/80s. That's patreon.com/80s, or click on the link in the description. So that's it for me. Thank you again so much for checking this show out. I'm Jamie. This has been Everything 80s, but I'll be back soon with a new episode. Don't you dare miss it.